morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockhorizon.com. On today's panel, we have Chief Investment Strategist John Portwood, and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tangus, and Greg Kudlewski. And our Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, will be the moderator.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our Market and Economic Update Call. John Portwood, we'll start with you. Last week, we saw the first release of third quarter GDP. It came in at a surprising 3.1%. 3.0%, and I believe that was a bit of a surprise given the major hurricanes that we saw take place during the third quarter. I think a lot of economists felt like there would be some disruption to the numbers as a result of those hurricanes, but we've had back-to-back strong quarters, both second quarter and third quarter, carrying a three handle. And, on this call, we've talked for years about the new normal and the 2% world that we've been in. And you've often referenced the new normal as described by Reinhardt and Rogoff about coming out of a financial crisis. It takes time for an economy to heal. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, in the book they say that, on average, it takes 10 years for an economy to fully heal after a financial crisis. We're at 9 years. Are we sort of getting to the point where maybe we're getting back to an economic environment that's a little bit healthier than the 2%, or are these back-to-back quarters really just kind of outliers and we're still sort of in the same environment?
Good question, Dave. You always hope that at some point things will normalize, as they say, and we get back into a situation that was probably a little bit more growthy, a little bit better economy for Main Street, as they say, rather than having a lot of the good things go to different areas of the economy, but there still seem to be some headwinds, and I guess the jury is still out on how this is going to work out. My guess is that we're still in a 2% plus or minus world. It's interesting that the mainstream economics group still describes or is currently describing the economy as solid. That wasn't the case 5 years ago. The word was we were going to get back to 3 or 4% fairly quickly, and it never happened. But they're still talking about the economy is solid. Somebody maybe facetiously called it humming along at 2%. But the new head of the Fed, Powell, or I guess he hadn't been confirmed yet, but he will be the new head of the Fed, has commented that the economy is growing robustly. So I guess we're still humming along at 2%, and everybody thinks that's reasonably robust at this point. We don't know what's going to happen with taxes. Historically, taxes have at times been reduced, and you can find some evidence that they added to economic growth fairly quickly, and you can find other times where it really didn't. So the jury is still out on what will happen from a tax standpoint, and I know Richard is going to talk about that in some detail, and that's enough to really make your head spin because it changes very often. But in any case, when you look at what's happening on a trend basis, you really don't see a great deal of change. The last quarter was driven about 30% by inventory accumulation, and maybe that's what was surprising. Some people are theorizing that the inventory accumulation might be a little early this year in terms of thinking about Christmas sales, but I don't think anybody knows where it came from completely. But anyway, inventory building was about a third of the gain, and as the inventories are worked off, of course, that reduces GDP. So there's some thinking that that quarter may have been a little bit of an anomaly. But in any case, year over year, 2.2%, pretty much in line with trend. And when you look back over the cycle since the Great Recession in 2008, you can see several instances where we have had year-over-year numbers as high as 3%, and then they fall back to something, you know, more like 2%, more in line with the current trend. 10-year number is 1.4%. That's driven a lot by, you know, what happened in 2008. We're still, of course, below where we would have expected to be, you know, given the historic trend. But labor force participation rate is not changing. You know, labor force has something to do, growth has something to do with economic growth. We're not seeing it. Some people expect the labor force participation rate to continue to fall, which is a negative for trend growth. Since the recession, we've also gotten more service jobs as a percent of private non-farm employment, and unfortunately, a lot of those service jobs are not high-paying, and that has continued to be the case to a fair degree, enough to make it noticeable. In recent years, that has been the case. One other thing interesting is that non-defense capital goods. Here we're talking about R&D expense, capital expense, all that sort of thing. Adjusted using just a six-month moving average, it's been flat for years. Now, that really hasn't changed a great deal either, so that would suggest that corporations are seeing, you know, relatively modest opportunities for capital expenditures and things like that so far. So at the present, it looks like, you know, we're in good shape as far as the economy is concerned. It's, the leading indicators are positive. All that looks pretty good. But, you know, unfortunately, it's far too early to suggest that, you know, we have really turned the corner, I guess, in terms of GDP trend growth. Too much debt, too. You know, debt's an issue going forward in terms of entitlement spending, which is about to accelerate fairly significantly in coming years. And taxes will have to be adjusted probably to take care of that. Nobody's talking about it now, but it's probably coming. So, again, perhaps, you know, something of a headwind to growth. So it's probably a little early, I guess, on average, looking at everything on average, to get too excited at this point.
So you're not declaring victory, but we're heading in the right direction.
Right. It looks like things are getting better, but just slowly.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Richard, you heard John mention tax reform, and a lot of economists believe that positive or productive tax reform could serve as a catalyst to get the economy moving in the right direction even further. And, you know, fortunately, it seems like we're heading in the right direction. You know, a fair amount of progress has been made. A bill has been introduced or at least made public, and I know it's sort of a evolving document. But if you could, maybe talk a little bit about where we are, some of the major provisions, some of the surprises, and where you think things are heading. So a lot in that question, but yeah. Just kind of bring us up to date on where things stand.
Will do, Dave, and it's definitely an evolving document. It was released several weeks ago, and not a lot of original surprises, but there have been a surprise or two since release. You know, this House bill, if it passed as is, which is unlikely, it would be the third largest net tax cut in history. It would fall behind the 1981 cut during the Reagan administration, as well as the 2003 cut from the Bush administration. The bill looks stimulative to the economy the way it's written. It looks like it would add about a percent to GDP over the next three calendar years if it stands as is. One of the things that's been a little bit of a surprise, perhaps because of the maybe a lack of coordination between the House and the Senate, the House worked very hard to to create a reconciliation rule to keep the plan, the tax plan, with a cost, a net cost of $1.5 trillion or less over 10 years. Well, come to find out just in recent days, there's a Senate rule that's called the Byrd rule from Senator Robert Byrd, from, you know, who was in the Senate for, I think, 40 years, who had a rule that was established there that says the following 10 years after the first 10, there's got to be some cost controls there as well. Well, this particular bill runs afoul of the Byrd rule, so that $1.5 trillion tax cut looks like we'll have to be trimmed back some more in order to be able to meet the Senate rules. So that's one reason we think there's going to be some changes to this bill. Otherwise, if not, the bill's major provisions would have to sunset after the first decade, which makes them a lot less effective in being stimulative to the economy, because no one wants to plan their personal or business lives around something that's going to definitely go away in the years ahead. And the other thing about that is that it's important to stay within the reconciliation rules, because that allows the bill to pass with a simple majority, and that is necessary because very little, if any, Democratic support is expected for this bill. So being able to pass the Senate with 51 votes is a lot easier. Still not easy necessarily, but easier than having to get to 60, which would be the case if it doesn't meet the rules. So there's the political side of this. The bill has some substantial opposition to it at this point, which again is not a real surprise there. But because of the fact that there's a cap in mortgage deductions, as well as the elimination of the deduction for state and local income taxes, there's a lot of parties that would come out against this bill, such as the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the Association of Realtors, and the Home Builders are all strongly, vociferously against the bill, as well as charitable groups. And I think the latter group, maybe because marginal tax rates go down, perhaps charitable giving gets to be less attractive, and that may be the way they look at that. Some of the major features we've talked about before, there will be four brackets. All of those on the individual side, all those brackets are lower than current tax rates for individuals. However, there's an unusual feature in the high bracket, for high income earners, that claws back the most modest 12% bracket for those individuals earning over $1 million or couples earning over $1.5 million a year. Obviously, this is the top tenth of a percent of the population. They would lose that 12% rate, which effectively would make their marginal tax rate something like 49%, as I understand it, which sort of a surprising feature in a Republican-sponsored bill. I found that to be a surprise. I think other people who found it were as well. The corporate tax rate would drop from 35% to 20%. That would be very helpful to the economy. Other helpful features for the economy include the 5 years of 100% expensing of capital equipment. That would be very helpful, I think, in the next economic cycle, as the country really needs a productivity boost. Productivity has been very anemic in the last 10 years, and many people think that's partially demographic factors, but also partially the lack of capital equipment spending by businesses, which helps workers be more productive, and that, of course, helps the middle class obtain real wage increases, which is most would say is sorely needed in the United States. Another feature that's getting some pushback is the 30% cap on corporate interest deductions. So if that gets through, the big losers of this bill would be highly indebted corporations. Some of the exemptions to that, of course, are utility companies and financial companies, which by their nature have to be heavily indebted. So they would be exempt from that. The winners in this bill would be smaller companies and domestically focused companies, because they would benefit most from the lower corporate tax rate. wrapping this up with a couple of comments. The Congressional Budget Office, which does the forecasting for the long-term effect of such bills as this, has scored it to be just a modest dynamic improvement from the $1.5 billion cost. And the House didn't even mention that in their release of the bill, which tells you they don't like it very much. But the CBO has been pretty bad about making accurate forecasts. So overall, it looks like it could be very helpful to the economy if it passes somewhere near its current form. But again, a lot to be determined between now and then. Next step is to get the bill ready for the Senate, which involves reducing its cost, and then the Senate will have to take it up. Very little time for this to happen this year. The window's closing. Best guess is this will probably not pass until the first quarter of 2018 and be retroactive to the beginning of 2018. And I think there's better than even odds that's going to happen because the motivation is very high to pass something. It may not be quite like the bill we see today, though. So those are my comments, Dave.
Okay. So better than even?
I'd say so, 70? But not this year, next year.
So what do you think the probability is there? I mean, I'm assuming there's a chance that nothing passes and we have a health care-like issue that just lingers on and we don't get any legislation.
Definitely possible, but I think the motivation is so high because so many Republican members of the House and Senate need some type of a win to go into the midterms elections in 2018. I think the bill may be less stimulative than the current bill, but I think something will pass because if they can stay within reconciliation, get the 51 votes in the Senate, something will come out. It may not be as powerful as the one you see today.
Okay. All right. Well, I suspect we'll be talking about it again next month and then the month after that one. So
definitely.
It's obviously a very important issue and has the potential to be a market moving either direction, depending on what happens in the next few months. So looking forward to continued progress there. Good morning, Jeff Dangus.
Good morning, Dave Lundgren.
Hey. So tax reform is not the only exciting thing going on in Washington. Janet Yellen's term ends in February, and last week President Trump officially nominated Jerome Powell to run the Federal Reserve going forward. So tell us about Mr. Powell, what you know, and I guess furthermore, how should the market react, assuming that he gets confirmed?
Well, as in most things that happen in Washington these days, especially things that are directed by Donald Trump, things have taken a little different turn than they have over the past several years. The incoming chair, Jerome, who goes by J-A-Y Powell, first of all, he's a lawyer and not an academic economist. So that's kind of an unusual. It's happened before. I think it's been two or three Fed chairs since we've had someone who wasn't an academic like this. But that definitely tells you that that Trump wanted to take a different turn with this this particular Federal Reserve chairman. He's seen as I've seen him referred to as Janet Yellen, in a suit. I've heard him referred to as Janet Yellen Light, all of which seems to indicate that he's not likely to change direction of things. He's been a Fed governor since 2011, so he's been around for a while. He was nominated by Barack Obama, and so he's not a boat rocker by any stretch of the imagination. I think he's seen as somebody who will be lean a little on the dovish side. There were a couple other folks that were in the running as the chairman, and some of which were much more hawkish than him. And I think I'm guessing here, but I would have to think that Donald Trump wanted somebody who was going to be a little more dovish, allow the economy to run a little hot, and keep rates lower, just because he wants to create jobs. So Jay Powell probably was the candidate most likely to fit that bill. closely. He supported Janet Yellen all along the way through QE and all the other programs that were involved. So he's a slow and steady guy. I think after the appointment, it still appears that the market in general anticipates rates to rise for the Fed to raise rates a couple times next year, much like they did under Janet Yellen. So the market hasn't really reacted very differently with his announcement. He's a consensus builder manager. He's not a kind of guy like a Yellen or a Bernanke who's got very strong opinions based on their academic background about what the Fed should do. As a lawyer, he's concerned with policy and how policy impacts markets and the banking system. He may be have a little lighter touch on regulation of the banking industry versus some of the academics. So good for the banking industry and finance industry in general. But he's a consensus builder, and that may be a strength or it may be a weakness of his. And the reason is because they have to also fill the vice chairmanship. And whoever fills the vice chairmanship, depending upon if they're a strong-willed person or more of a consensus person, they may have the ability to kind of nudge Jay Powell in one direction or another. So it could be that if there's a group of Fed governors that become more hawkish, that they may be able to coerce him in one direction or another. So the appointment of that vice chair is seen as a very critical indicator of really the direction that the committee and Jay Powell may go in. Also recently announced just in the last couple of days was the New York Fed President Dudley has announced he's going to step down early. And those three, between the chair, the vice chair, and the New York Fed President, those are sort of the troika, the three real power players on the whole committee. So with all three new people coming into roles, it's a little bit of a guessing game as to how this will all fill out. Trump does not appoint the New York Fed president. That's done by an independent outside group of directors. So it's not going to be the political process that the chair selection was. So there is there's a lot of change going on at the Fed. Again, it seems like the Fed is likely to continue on the same trajectory. The trend has been that the Fed plans on raising rates. The market is skeptical about that. I haven't looked recently. I think the Fed, what they call the dot plot, which is what the Fed puts out there as kind of their consensus action for the next couple of years, puts them at 3 or 4 increases for next year. The market probably is at 2. So the market is not convinced yet that the Fed's going to do all that it says it's going to do. But either way, we know that the Fed, it's a given the Fed will continue to raise rates as long as the economy continues to chug along. Inflation is obviously not an issue. And the tax package, whatever passed, is probably additive to the economy. So there's no reason to think that the Fed is going to change direction on that. So I'd say an increase again of 25 basis points in December, which gets the upper range up to 1.5%, still very, very low by historical standards. Look for probably 2 to 3 increases next year. And so we're at that point, you know, we've got a 2 handle at the end of next year, still very, very manageable from an economic standpoint, assuming that the economy doesn't show some weakness weakness more in 2019. as we get pretty long in the tooth with this recovery. So a lot going on there, kind of a windy explanation, but with three positions open, there's plenty to talk about at the Fed, Dave.
Great. Well, thank you, Jeff. And I'm looking at the dot plot as we speak, and it looks like anticipating the December hike, as you mentioned, and then three additional hikes in 2018. So pretty ambitious dot plot. And like you said, the market is not believing, but we shall see. Greg Hileski, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, what an amazing run for stocks. It's just incredible. We're looking up the stats, and for 2017, we've had 10 months, and we've had 10 positive months for the S&P 500. Just truly amazing. S&P 500 in the month of October was up 2.3%. Small cap stocks didn't fare as well, almost 1%, a little bit less. And then international stocks up about 1.5%. So all in all, yet another good month. And I know we're in the midst of earnings season, so maybe if you could talk a little bit about the month of October. Talk about what earnings are looking like. So I guess we're in the third quarter reporting season, and then a little bit of an outlook for the remainder of the year. Greg?
Yeah, exactly. It was very positive. Again, I think we're now entering the 104th month of this long market, bull market, whatever uptrend, if you want to call it, that began in March of 2009. As you pointed out, you know, Dow was up 4.5% for the month. The S&P capitalization indices returned to that pattern that we've talked about all year, where larger issues were beating smaller issues. The S&P, as you said, was up 2.3, mid-caps up about 2.3, and then small caps, barely 1%. That puts the year-to-date return on the Dow at 20.6, S&P 500 at 16.9, S&P mid-cap at 11.9, and again, the small-cap year-to-date at 10%. So nothing to sniff at in terms of market returns, and particularly in the context of, you know, historical returns. So turning to style indices, growth continues to outpace value, with the growth index up 3.3 for the month. Value stocks trailed at 1.2. So I think that, again, is a result of people favoring growth of your stocks given the somewhat anemic recovery in the economy. Also, anything that pays a dividend continues to be positive, with the S&P Dividend Aristocrats up 1.5%, and these are just total returns. The High Yield Aristocrats up 1.3, and the Dow Jones U.S. Select up 1.3. International markets were also up. The developed markets index was up 1.8. Emerging markets did a little bit better, posting a 2.6% return. Frontier markets, which are the smallest end of the emerging type markets, were up 0.24. And Asian markets did the best for the month, returning 5.7, so very strong there. From a sector standpoint, we saw tech, that really hit it out of the ballpark for the month. That was up, technology sector was up 7.8%, followed by utilities up 3.9%, and material stocks up 3.9% also. On the downside, telecom was down about 7.6%, followed by consumer staples down 1.4%, and then finally healthcare down about 0.8%. On the earnings front, yes, we are about halfway through, and about half the companies reported, so half of this growth number that I'm going to report is actual reporting, and the other half are estimates yet, so you could still be tilted one way or the other, but it looks like the earnings growth rate right now is coming in at about 4.7% for the quarter, which is pretty low. We've seen some double-digit increases earlier in the year and late last year, so the biggest attractor to that growth rate has been the insurance industry, as you might guess, or at least that's what they're saying has caused their lower rates of earnings. And, you know, you had a couple of hurricanes, you had the Mexico earthquake. So if you exclude just the insurance sector, the growth rate for the S&P 500 jumps to about 7.4%. So Again, presumably all this is related to hurricanes and the earthquake in Mexico. But we'll see how the rest of the quarter goes, and then, of course, the fourth quarter we'll be reporting next year. For the balance of 2017, sure looks like more of the same at this point. I mean, don't see any kind of a recessionary outlook, and so I don't see anything on the horizon within, you know, the last 2 months here of 2017 that should change things unless all of a sudden North Korea seriously erupts upward. But looking out to 2018, even with GDP estimates, if you conservatively look at it from a 2 to 2.6% range, looks like earnings this year should come in at about $128 for the S&P 500. And right now, estimates for 2018 are looking at $142, implying about an 11% increase, which isn't too bad. So I think as long as earnings can keep up, along with market prices, that should help keep P.E. ratios somewhat in line. So really, still looking pretty positive, and global growth seems to be looking at about 3%, so I think we're probably going to continue to see that trend with larger cap companies probably outperforming smaller caps. And that's all I have for this morning.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Join us again next month when our call will be Tuesday, December 5th. Talk to you then. Thank you.